Can we restart again? Do we have to introduce the members? We don't have to. You know them, eh? Oh, okay. But we want you to introduce yourself, because there's a new face that we don't know. So if you could just introduce her, and then you'll carry on with your presentation, if you are ready.
Thanks, and once again, thank you for inviting us to come and present to you what we've been doing in the previous years. I'm our chairperson.
My name is William Dick. I chair the Council for Medieval Schemes, and it's an honor for me to be here today to present to you what we've done last year.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Dan Lukuj, I'm the Chief Financial Officer of the Council for Medieval Schemes.
Thank you.
yeah, already someone has picked up that there's another acting person.
There's something that I'm acting with you also.
Well, I'm there.
You're a Hollywood, okay? Another Hollywood.
Yeah, I probably will keep a few slides which deals more with the structure of council, largely due to the fact that most of the people who are here would probably be familiar.
Can I apologize to the members that we don't have these copies? Somebody is still photocopying them, I'm told, that they are coming.
Yes.
So you'll just be presenting from...
Yeah, what we have done was just to distill the annual report. So the assumption we have made was that having gone through the report, this would just provide a summary. We apologize for not printing the slides of my presentation, but it won't be any different to the content of the report. And we are also making the assumption that everyone got a copy, because we sent about 100 copies back in September, as required by law. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
This is just an outline of my presentation. Like I said, I'll just highlight the legislative mandate and maybe skip asking. As you know, the council is a statutory body that was established in terms of the Medical Schemes Act 131 of 1998, with key mandates really being to promote non-discriminatory access to privately funded health care through open enrollment, where everyone wants to join a medical scheme care, except for restricted medical schemes. Community rating, where the structuring of contributions shouldn't be based on any other criteria other than income, number of dependents, or income and number of dependents. And the third being guaranteed benefits, where the government said every member of a medical scheme will be guaranteed a set of minimum benefits, which we call prescribed minimum benefits, where there are 270 disease treatment tests, followed by 26 chronic conditions, and lastly, emergency medical cover. Our other legislative mandate is to promote financial stability and sustainability, and to encourage active participation of members in scheme affairs through participation in governance structures. And lastly, to investigate and resolve complaints from members. Just to underscore the fact that the Medical Schemes Act is one component of what needs to happen. There are other legislative provisions that impact on the business that we do. The National Health Act being one, Medicines and Related Substances Act, Health Professions Act, Pharmacy Act, Nursing Act, and of course the Competitions Act. This played itself out particularly in 2004, when the tariff arrangement method was cancelled or deemed illegal, and that was done away with, and we all know today what that unraveled. Total chaos in the industry, which the department is trying to remedy at the moment. Those are just our functions. They entail protection of members, control and coordination of the industry, assisting the ministry with the quality-related issues, investigation of complaints, collection and dissemination of information, making of rules not inconsistent with provision of this act, but also to advise the minister on any matter pertaining to the medical scheme and to perform any other function that the minister will confer on us. That's just our vision. Our strategic objectives, they flow from our statutory objectives. In terms of accountability structure, that's the structure. You've got the council that is headed by myself at the moment. You've got the council which is appointed by the minister. The chair is Professor Peak. And of course, everything cascades upwards. We report directly to the minister, but we interact closely with the Department of Health. And that's just the composition of the council. and the council's subcommittee. That's the office of the registrar. It's got various departments: financial supervision, research and monitoring, compliance and educational training, legal services, complaints, accreditation, benefits management, the adjudicate on benefits, and support entities such as IT, HR, as well as internal finance. Our total staff complement is 78 staff. Total budget for the year under review was around 60 million rand. And maybe just to flag the fact that our financial year would ordinarily be different to the financial year of medical schemes, because medical schemes start from January to December. We start from April to March. We've got what we call the REP project, which I'll elaborate on later on. I'll start by highlighting what the office has been doing in the previous years. This entails ongoing support for the Risk Equalization Fund, and this program is continuing against the backdrop of it having been started for particular purpose, but we are constantly reviewing the progress, but also, we are interacting very closely with the department just to ensure that there's alignment with the proposed health reform process. And the same can be said for prescribed minimum benefits. We have been working on the Medical Schemes Amendment Bill. We recently realized that the bill has lapsed, and we are following up on that. The bill sought to do two things. The first were technical amendments, which dealt with the definition of the business of the medical scheme, which definition came under challenge through the GARD risk legal case, and I'll expatiate a bit more on that. The second component is the opportunistic behavior that we pick up in the environment, particularly by providers, where because the legislation says payment for PMB should be done at cost or in full. Providers in the space where there aren't rules in terms of tariffs as a consequence of the Competition Act intervention have begun to charge whatever the market can bear. And sometimes those charges can go as high as 400% above the NHS tier. And for the life of me, health being a non-commoditized aspect, it becomes very difficult for members to negotiate in that regard. So it is that component that we would be engaging with the Department of Health, largely to have those minor corrections effected, because unless that is done, it's got fundamental implications on how business is going to unfold in the medical system environment. The second set of amendments were pretty substantive, and we understood why those have to be packed for now until there's clarity on where the broader legislative reform process is going. This is REF, the review of benefit structures. This speaks to the ever-increasing problem of benefits running out midstream governance. You probably would have seen a lot of media reports on some of the undetermined governance problems by medical schemes. We had to think through what possible interventions could be brought about to help stem the tide.
And the last bit was the no income in health scheme, which was intended to begin to inculcate a culture of subscription to medical scheme. The other aspect we have been working on together with the Department of Health as well as Treasury is what we call demarcation. As you know, the review of the Long and Short Term Insurance Act has brought with it provisions which allow for the Minister of Finance to exempt certain entities from being classified as doing the business of medical scheme. It is a challenging situation given the fact that the guard's pronouncement didn't clarify the definition of a medical scheme. However, it allowed certain entities to trade, the effect of which has been a creation of a parallel insurance structure, which we sit with today. We are seeing an increasing number of medical schemes heading the benefits, particularly those that operate in the life environment as well, by ensuring that not only do you join a medical scheme, but you also find yourself subscribing to some of these products, largely to deal with the 400% that I spoke about. We are participating in the Treasury process, which seeks to develop regulations that will delineate between those products as well as the medical scheme products. I must confess, the process is not the most ideal in that it being led by Treasury, it has now been left to the industry, the insurance industry, to determine the agenda. And we've got serious reservations around that, and it is something that we obviously will have to interact with the respective authorities in order to address the problem. Secondly, we do have the so-called primary care insurance products that encroach on the medical schemes environment, and those tend to break the risk pools. And when we pick that up, we duly intervene. We know that your Regent insurance have got a primary care product. We have seen other similar products being heavily marketed on Morning Live and various other programs. So we are monitoring those. And these are just the other additional processes that we have been involved in at Council. This, by the way, is in addition to our normal operational activities of ensuring that contributions and benefits are adjudicated upon, ensuring that there's adequate enforcement and compliance by entities in the environment, ensuring that we continue to train and inform and educate all the stakeholders in the environment, ranging from ordinary members of the public, unions, companies, and any other stakeholder that requires our training, but also not forgetting trustees, because from time to time we get a new crop of trustees joining the environment, and those are, when necessary, subjected to our training processes, just to bring them up to speed. The one last thing I need to flag is the complaints. We adjudicate on complaints. And in the previous financial year, we had a total of 3,138 valid complaints. When I say valid, I mean complaints which, when they were adjudicated upon, were found to be worthy of being considered a complaint, as the definition of a complaint in the legislation. Others would ordinarily be your insurance products, or inquiries that did not necessarily deal with the concerns pertaining to medical schemes. In total, that was 3,000, but a breakdown tended to yield the following results. We had 37.2% constituting unpaid accounts. This, obviously, are results you have seen before. Except that when we presented them, they were not yet final results because we're still crunching the numbers, but these are the final ones. And what constitutes the bulk of unpaid accounts is largely to do with communication between the scheme as well as the members, payment for PMBs, pre-authorization, and benefit extortion, and the rest just follows. Now, I want to give a quick rundown of the business of
medical schemes, but what I presented was the operations of the office itself. So the following slide will reflect how the business of medical schemes unfolded in the year 2008, moving into 2009. In terms of a breakdown, we've got medical schemes, which are by and large considered to be not-for-profit entities. We had a total of 119 in 2008, 82 of which were restricted schemes, your employer-based, union-based, or profession-based medical schemes, and 37 were your normal open schemes, your body health discovery, etc. And maybe just to flag the fact that those entities have got sufficient legislative regulation barring those additional bids that needs to be effective. We do, however, also have other entities which we call commercial intermediaries. These tend to operate in the broader private health environment. They are not restricted to the medical schemes environment, but the broader private health environment. We've got administrators, some of whom are linked to large companies, your Old Mutual, Discovery Health, Momentum, etc. And this tends to create certain administrative and regulatory challenges for the office, largely to do with the reasons I've articulated before, to say they can sometimes undermine the provisions of legislation in that environment. The legislation is not as tight as it ordinarily would be for medical schemes. We've got 23 of those. Then we've got brokers. Brokers are registered under two legislative provisions, as you know. The first is the financial services legislation, and the second is ours. And again, they are free to sell whatever products their mandate allows them to. So they will sell medical schemes, but sometimes we hear, due to the fact that they consider the broker fee of 3% to be too little, they will pad that with other products such as life, etc. Brokerage companies, likewise, they do the same. And then managed care entities, we've got 55 of them. Now, in terms of trends, we have seen a reduction, perhaps also a consolidation in the number of medical schemes, particularly restricted medical schemes, some of which have been absorbed into the open medical schemes environment. As that was happening, we did not necessarily see or experience a reduction in the number of membership. It has, for the most part, stayed fairly consistent. This reflects coverage of beneficiaries. As you can see, from 2000, when the Act was implemented, up until 2006, membership has remained fairly stagnant. In 2006, as we now all know, the government employees medical scheme was introduced, and we then started seeing an increase in membership. What this graph also shows is the effect of the provision of subsidies at the entry point as opposed to after the fact, in that for the most part, membership of medical schemes has been linked to employment, but more specifically to tax. So most people who pay tax will ordinarily enjoy the benefit in that they get a tax rebate. But since the introduction of GEMS, GEMS subsidizes members slightly differently because the employer provides cover, and that cover allows a subscription to medical scheme membership. And we have seen a significant enrollment of membership into GEMS. Currently, I'm told it stands at 1 million beneficiaries, which has put them as the second biggest medical scheme in the environment after Discovery Health. This just reflects the demographic profile. As you can see, in terms of open medical schemes, there seems to be an aging profile from 31.9 in 2007 to 32.6. But in terms of restricted schemes, the opposite effect has been experienced, largely because GEMS has been able to bring very young profiles into the system. Now, switching on to contributions, in 2008,
the total amount of contribution collected by medical schemes amounted to 74 billion. That is against claims that were paid of 64.9 billion. But importantly, when you look at the increase in contribution was 13.2%, while that of claims was 13.6%, partly as a consequence of the tariff system that I mentioned. And the risk and saving only helped to break down where the funding pool came from. As you know, with risk, that's the pool that is shared amongst all members, but with savings, those are individualized entitlements for medical team members. When adjusted for membership, a member of medical team on average paid 733 rand in 2007, which went up by 9.2% to 800 rand in 2008. And likewise, for risk and savings, we provide a breakdown. The following slide shows the trend in contribution over time. And as you can see, between 1999 and 2004, between 1999 and 2004, we saw a very rapid increase in contribution, and this is after adjusting for inflation. Part of the reason for that has been the rush to meet the solvency requirements, which OSCIM had to meet of 25%. But also, it was to do with uncontrolled contribution increases by medical schemes, which is something that from 2004 going forward has been attended to sufficiently address and is being monitored on an ongoing basis. Despite it being flat, we feel the contributions are still high, but unless other supply-side factors are addressed, we might continue to see those contributions remaining at those high levels. We have seen an increase in claims as well, but after 2004, when the Competition Commission intervened, we saw a rapid increase in those claims from providers. At the same time, the impact on the claim ratio, the value proposition to a member, has been a decrease in what they were entitled to up until that point when schemes were cash awash, as it were, and we began to see an appreciable increase in the value proposition for members. This graph looks at a different perspective of the activities in the environment and looks at utilization of services. As you can see, in 2007, 731 members out of 1,000 visited a GP, and this equates to 3 GP visits per annum. That has since gone down to 721. And we suspect that the effect of that has been an increased out-of-pocket expenditure by members. We haven't necessarily quantified it, but we have seen a shrinkage in the entitlement of members, largely for those non-PLD benefits. The same trend was observed for dentistry, for hospitalization as well. Despite the reduction in the utilization, we saw an increase in the proportion allocated to hospitals, and needless to say, the bulk of that 37%, which equates to around 23 billion, goes to private hospitals. And a very negligible amount, less than 1%, goes to public hospitals. And there are a myriad of factors why that is so. That is followed by medical specialists who enjoyed 21% of the price that was paid to healthcare providers in 2008, then medicine, and the GP at 8.1%. When one looks at the same graph differently in terms of the trend, we have seen a rapid increase in the total amount of money paid to hospitals. And like I said, those will be private hospitals. By comparison, public hospitals are way, way below. And last year, in 2008, I think they only collected $225 million, which had reduced by around 27% from over $300 million. That was followed by medical specialists and then medicine. With medicine, several factors happened. Medical schemes started tightening, medicine consumption by introducing formularies. But in the process, in 2004, the new legislation on medicine was introduced, so it further led to a reduction in the amount paid, or in the cost of medicine that medical team consumers or medical team members, and that only reflects your GP. Now, in terms of net healthcare results, these are operating results from medical teams. I did indicate that medical teams were in a rush to build their reserves, and that is reflected even in terms of their operating results. But after that, some of them started subsidizing contributions of members from their kitty. But others began to feel the pressure of the intervention by the Competition Commission. So what you see here is a multifactorial phenomenon. One, where medical teams have substantial solvency, they will use that to subsidize contributions. But if that has got poor management structures, would obviously feel the pinch, providers would game the system. But as a result of investment income, a lot of them, despite making operating losses, were still able to balance their books sufficiently well. Again, the trend continues, as you can see, up until 2004. The solvency build-up continues, but once in fact they had met their obligations, they started moderating around that. And as I'm speaking, most of the schemes need solvency, but we are aware that there are a few that are battling, and some are currently facing amalgamations and at worst liquidation. But we are monitoring the situation very closely. Now, turning on to non-healthcare expenditure, I know that this has been a topical issue, and it remains a serious cause for concern, not only to yourself, but also to the council. And that is why there has been stringent requirements for compliance, but also enforcement of legislation. The non-healthcare in this case will constitute administration fees, managed healthcare fees, broker fees, as well as impaired receivables, which is your bad debt. Now, starting with non-healthcare expenditure overall, schemes pay $9.7 billion for administration of services in medical fees, and this will constitute the breakdown that I gave you. When you split it up into admin expenditure, that was $6.8 billion, which increased by about 6.5%. And here we give a split between open and restricted schemes. And as you can see, the increase has been a bit higher for restricted schemes. That was largely as a consequence of the growth of GEM, but the amount will obviously reflect precisely that. But that doesn't mean that we are happy with the level at which it is at. We would prefer that members get a bit more value as opposed to the funds being directed too much to this entity. Again, we give an adjusted fee, which is 87.5 rand for open scheme and 48.6 rand for the pre-termination scheme. Part of the reason for the difference, though, is that the restricted medical schemes don't necessarily market their products, but open medical schemes that do market, so that does play a role. You probably would have seen in some stadia big billboards of Pharos, Discovery Health, Resolution, etc. That's where some of that money goes. In terms of managed health care, we have seen an increase of 9.4% to 1.7 billion. What these entities does is likely to intervene in terms of financial and clinical risk management. Some will, for example, contract to service members for diabetes, where they manage diabetes for members of the medical team. Others will manage HIV, and still others will manage the entire primary health care and provision, whilst others will manage hospital transactions. Currently, about 98.6% of all beneficiaries in this system have got one form of managed care intervention or another. Broker fee, this has also been quite a big area of concern for us, largely when you try to peg the fee against the number of members that were being brought about. We have seen an 11.6% increase to 1.2 billion. And part of the reason for that increase has been the current phenomenon where brokers are raiding what we call orphan members. Where they realize that they are orphan members, they approach companies to service their members, and the scheme need only pay for those broker fees, and that tends to push the fees up. The other portion, obviously, is your normal commission that they are entitled to. So we are, again, looking at that, which is why we developed that broker document. It was likely to begin to distinguish between what we call tied agents, who will recruit members for a specific scheme, and independent brokers who will recruit for all schemes. And the method of funding for those two entities or parties will obviously be different. Again, this just shows the trend in broker fees that I explained. Gross non-healthcare expenditure, this is the trend that has taken place. As a result of our intervention, we have seen a slowing down of broker non-healthcare expenditure fees, even though, as I said, we feel they are still not at the level at which we could pop the champagne and celebrate that the intervention has been effective. So we are monitoring that on an ongoing basis. Impaired receivable, this just indicates the amount of contributions that medical schemes are owed. We have seen an increase in the amount of bad debt that schemes incur. But that is partly due to the fact that some schemes collect contributions in arrears, others collect in prospectively. So it is one area, again, that we obviously are monitoring very closely. Average gross claims covered by cash, this is the amount of money that your medical scheme keeps to cover your costs. We have seen a slight decline from past month to past 1 month. So medical schemes on average have got enough cash to cover past month's contribution for members should something happen. And that to us gives some comfort. That is the purpose for which the solvency requirements were put in place. Now, in terms of what we found, there is an increasing consolidation, no doubt, in the medical schemes environment. We think, and we say it's a good thing, because the smaller the number of schemes, the better the risk pool. And when we've got a bigger risk pool, it augurs well for normal health insurance principles. As I indicated, we haven't seen any net loss in membership as a result of this consolidation. If anything, as a consequence of the introduction of GEPs, we have seen an increase. The rate of increase in contributions and claims appears to have increased, and we are monitoring it for the reasons that I've articulated. schemes are subsidizing contributions from reserves, possibly to minimize the impact on contributions on members. But where this happens, we tend to request a solvency strategy just to ensure that the scheme doesn't find itself in difficult challenges. There has been a general decline in utilization of services by members, and our concern really remains that perhaps some of these utilization reductions are being diverted to out-of-pocket payments. The demographic profile is obviously worsening, particularly in open medical schemes, and that has got a contribution increase implications. Despite all this, we still find that when one looks at the one primary indicator that we use to assess financial stability, schemes are generally financially sound. However, there are those that are suffering, and we are managing those. Non-healthcare expenditure is coming down. We are not happy yet, but we continue to monitor that. And maybe lastly, the number of complaints are still too high for our comfort, and it is something that we obviously are watching carefully, just to ensure that we raise it to the best interest of our members. Now, in terms of challenges, as I indicated, we've got demarcation issues, where we are seeing a parallel insurance strategy emerging. And unless something is done now, specifically for purposes of the medical schemes environment, but also going forward for the new proposed health reform process, this might create serious problems. And those are the two levels at which we are looking at it. The first is to have a serious rethink of the definition of medical schemes. And as I indicated, we'll be interacting with the department just to explore ways and means of addressing that issue. Again, the issue of long and short-term insurance legislation, that needs to be looked at. Because we feel it might perhaps present serious problems if Treasury would not determine health policy through this, what I call a backdoor opportunity that has been presented to them as a consequence of the legislation. The second issue which begins to talk to the tariff is the crisis of medical services. It has always been our contention that one way or the other, there needs to be some mechanism whereby the price in the medical schemes environment are standardized. And the only way to do that is to have a tariff. Even lawyers have got their own tariff, so we don't see why medical schemes shouldn't have that. In our meeting with the minister, we were informed that there are discussions underway with the Competition Commission, and the discussion revolves around the acknowledgement that it is very difficult for a member of the public to negotiate medical services with a medical provider. I think there are no classes for gazing that if I've got a chest pain and my doctor says ECG instead of this thing, who am I to argue against that? I have to tag along. And if the bill comes at 1,000, again, you know, I can't adjudicate on the fairness or lack thereof of that price. And those are the things we are trying to correct, and that is why we are closely working with the Department of Health to correct that. The third issue is prescribed minimum benefits. I think here what we will be requesting, which is an amendment that might come to yourself, is clarification. Not a legislative amendment, but clarification on what the legislature envisaged when they said payment for PMD should be done at school, particularly in an environment where we operate, where now every medical scheme knows that certain bills from certain providers come with a tag PMD. And once that happens, the provider can charge whatever they want. And when the complaint comes to us, we can only adjudicate on that complaint within the broad parameters of the law. And if the law says, pay the doctor whatever he charges, that's what we'll adjudicate upon. It's not healthy for the medical team. It's very opportunistic on the part of those providers who are doing it. And I must admit, it's not all of them, but it's the few bad apples that create problems in the environment. And the last bit is that the governance, obviously, hardly the governance provisions don't have sufficient punitive measures. We have experienced serious governance challenges from certain medical teams. Obviously, we didn't fold our hands and let them do as they please. We have taken some to court, the most recent of which is Bonita. It falls outside that reporting period, but it was a culmination of work that started way back, where we realized that Board of Trustees were not paying particular focus on that which they were there for in the first place, that we suspect they are probably not fit and proper. And as I'm speaking, we've just completed an inspection, which inspection was commissioned by the High Court, and we will then adjudicate on this issue going forward. Other similar governance challenges are your Gen Health, which is a scheme that was put under curatorship for Sano. It was also put under curatorship largely for governance reasons. Because each time those things occur, it is the members of medical schemes that end up bearing the brunt. And us being the custodians of the interests of those members, I have to do something about it. And unfortunately, sometimes we have to stretch our legal budget in order to correct whatever misdemeanor we pick up in the environment. And just lastly, this is my last slide. We are acutely aware that the landscape has shifted. We have been familiarized with the 10-point plan of government, where government seeks to address some of the inherent problems, not only in the medical environment, but in the broader healthcare environment, which will obviously include the medical environment. We are fully supportive of all of those plans because we feel that they lend themselves well to the environment in which we operate in terms of improvement of public health care facilities, recruitment of staff, stewardship at the highest level. This is not general acceptance that HIV causes AIDS, and that's a major improvement. So participation in the NHI advisory committee to us is of importance, and our chairperson is a participant in there. And the reason for our participation is largely due to the fact that we feel there's ample expertise, there's ample skills base, there's ample understanding of the environment in which we operate to can lend itself well to the process. And we hope to play a very positive role, and where there's the need for critical assessment, we will obviously duly do that. But we hope that ultimately the process will benefit from our participation. We do have ongoing interaction with the Department of Health as part of our mandate to contribute to the development of health policy. And we are working with them on the Medicine Pricing Commission, which has been set, and it is a process that we are excited about, in that it lends again itself well positively to the environment in which we operate. And that concludes our presentation. We have not necessarily prepared an itemized budget presentation because we thought we'd be discussing from the annual report themselves. It is something that we are keen to look at, and we will entertain any questions directly linked to my presentation, but also checking out from the report itself. We did try to include some of the requirements by the AG, if only as a first year of introduction. There's a full set of our performance evaluation that we were told needs to be in, but going forward, it will be mandatory. So this year we just put it in just to show you how we have fed relative to the agenda of the menu that we set ourselves for. But going forward, it's something that AG obviously evaluates as part of the adjudication process. And let me just conclude by saying that we are also happy about the pronouncement of the AG with regard to our budget, that for 9 years running, we continue to receive unqualified audits and it is something that has put a lot of pressure on ourselves. And we like it, we don't like it, but it keeps us on our toes. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Acting CEO. We wonder why is this not a clean report? Why does it always remain an unqualified? This is a clean report, so we should move towards a clean report. Members, as I'm listening, the presentation, except for those who were not there, the presentation is not very different from the presentation that we got when we had just gone in as members of Parliament and the Health Committee. But I'm sure there might be some questions that the members want to ask you. And I think it's a mind, it's a very deep mind in medical aid. But we're not talking to the medical aid, we're talking to you as the council. But there are a whole lot of problems that maybe the members would go into. But one would be interested in knowing the reasons why the public hospitals are not using the medical aid. I've got an interest. The other one is, you're looking after your members. But I take it that one of the things, which is something that I was going to ask the NHLS, whether the other countries do have EXTR, which is the extremely resistant TB. You know, one of the reasons probably why we should be having things like that, I'm not saying that is the only reason, but when I've got a medical aid, I'm working in a mine somewhere for the medical aid, and I become 6, 6, 6, 7 again, and around September my medical aid is finished. And then they ask me to, they just leave me like that when I was being treated for TB. Then I've got to fend for myself, getting treatment somewhere. And I end up going to the public hospital. And by the way, I still don't even believe that I've got TB, because it has got stigma to it. I refuse to accept. So I go to the other doctors. They see me having been treated for TB. And they don't see TB. They see something else. And they said, no, none of the treatment. And later on, I developed XDR. I think these are some of the things that are making us unhealthy in South Africa. So how do you handle those things? I'm just interested. I'm just asking a question. I'm not sure how far could you go with Bonita, as an example. How far would you go with the present situation? But we don't want you to delve into things that you're not supposed to delve into the legal. But if you could just give us. I know these are non-profit organizations, but there's a lot of things that are happening, despite the fact that I'm not sure all of them, that I don't think all of them are non-profit. But the way you look at it is, I'm not sure whether our legislation is failing, but there is something that probably needs to be done, but you will tell us. Members, I was just paving the way for you. Do you have any questions, or maybe you can just answer those questions and then call it a day?
I think with regard to public hospitals, my colleague from the department
for Benny out. The first challenge is that in 2004, the Department of Health amended their legislation to say where PMBs are involved, a scheme ordinarily should have what we call a designated service provider, meaning you can select a group of facilities for provision of PMBs. That was done largely to minimize financial risk, but to standardize clinical risk. The thinking was that not only will the private sector benefit, but the intention was to try to skew things more in favor of public hospitals, given the network that they have. There were attempts made by medical schemes to contract with provinces. As you know, you can't contract with individual hospitals. Western Cape bid, and they now have contractual arrangements with a number of medical schemes. Gauteng tested the waters, but pulled back. There's a contract that was prepared but never signed. KZN came in late in the game.
but they are in the process of entering into that. So as a result, public hospitals never benefited. The second challenge was that when members present at those facilities, sometimes the hospital is unable to follow the claim with the medical scheme. They either don't have systems or the requisite competency to follow the money up. And that has created problems. In other instances, we were told about revenue retention challenges to say what is the point of following up this money if it will end up in the central treasury. You know, so those are a myriad of factors that we think might have impacted negatively on public hospitals not taking advantage of the opportunity that was presented to them. About 2-3 years ago, the department spearheaded what is called designated service provider network, which was an attempt to create a network of hospitals that is that could contract with the medical scheme. I'm not certain how successful that has been. Maybe my colleagues can comment on that. On the second issue of XDR-TB, the PMB package covers TB and by extension MDR-TB and XDR-TB, but it also covers HIV, and again TB is will be covered there. Medical scheme members have had this benefit since the inception of the legislation, but it was enhanced when the national standards were determined, it then covered DCT, prophylaxis, post-exposure prophylaxis, etc. We did a study in 2004 to try to determine as to why people were not tripping over themselves in accessing the benefits. And the challenges have been multiple. One, confidentiality. Today they go to this provider, tomorrow they go to a different one. Two, it has been, I think, the stigma associated with the disease. But thirdly, we have always assumed that private medical practitioners were clueless in the treatment of HIV. And to our surprise, not all of them were at that level of competence in dealing with HIV conditions. Some will go as far as referring them to someone else. And that in itself can create a problem. But there could be various other reasons. But today, as I'm sitting here, TB is a PMB. It's recognized as such. And it should be treated in that manner. There is a proposed initiative by the minister to canvas widely issues around HIV as well as TB, and we have been requested to explore how that can be done within the medical scheme environment, and it is something that we have taken up, and it is something that we will be looking at to try to see what we can do for that. With Bonitas is a reflection of some of the ills in our system where you've got passive shareholders, because medical scheme members are shareholders. They are also participants, but for the most part, their passive is that they wouldn't necessarily participate in meetings. And as a result, it is not unthinkable that people will take advantage of the situation and try to extend themselves in one way or the other. So when we identified those unfortunate developments within Bonita, we had to approach the High Court, realizing some of the legal challenges that they were preparing to launch against us. We approached the High Court for an inspection. We can do an inspection within the parameters of the law, but it's got certain limitations. So the reason to approach the High Court was for us to get at least a mandated inspection. But not only that, for the High Court to appoint someone else other than ourselves to investigate on an independent and impartial basis and then give us the responses. And I must admit, when we did that, we then learned that they had hired two very powerful legal entities to oppose. Unfortunately for them, the evidence was just too weighty to oppose. So what we're sitting with now is the conclusion of the report, which we will receive at the end of November, and subsequent to that, we will then make a decision on what our next course of action will be. And that is a similar situation we approached with Resolution Health, which was doing more or less the same, where medical scheme funds were being siphoned out of the scheme through all sorts of convoluted means. And lastly, all medical schemes are for profit. Unfortunately, some of them happen to be administered by entities that have got other commercial interests. I'll give an example. If you take Discovery Health or Liberty Momentum, the administrator administers a medical scheme on the one hand, but they also administer a life company on the other hand. And it is possible that they could have various other add-ons. So what will happen in that case is the administrator will assist the medical scheme in terms of their product, but will also take advantage of this captive market to sell other products like your life, etc., and this gap cover. And that is one area that obviously remains of concern to us, and it needs to be looked at earnestly just to protect members. Because our concern was heightened last week when we got a call from the principal officer of GEMS, who indicated to us that there is a company which, as they recruit government employees into the scheme, that company tells them and recruits those people into what is called a gap cover, which gap cover is marketed as if it's been authorized by GEMS. What could happen? So those are some of the issues we're looking at with a view to intervening and where possible institution punitive measures against the entities. But medical schemes remain for profit. They submit financial statements to us, we monitor them, and where there are shortcomings, we do the interview.
Thanks.
Members,
any questions? I know this presentation has been done.
If I can.
One thing, do the last page on the NHI Advisory Committee. You said that the council, well, the chair is participating. What's the view of the council as far as the NHI is concerned, and where do you see medical aid fitting in to the NHI in the future? Do you see a future for medical aid schemes, or will it become defunct? And what role are you playing, and what advice are you giving in the Advisory Committee? Thank you.
Thanks, Mike. I think one is to take a contextual view of where the council comes from when it, with regards to health reform process. In 2004, we assisted the department in developing a legislative framework which would have taken a trajectory approach to NHI, and that was through social health insurance. And that was done largely to ensure that the current market is expanded, if only on a gradual basis, towards that eventuality. We now know that that process has been short-circuited, as I indicated previously. And we don't yet have any clarity on the NHI process, but we understand the broader framework of what it seeks to do. And it is on that basis that we are participating in order to contribute positively to the process. And if it is a situation where medical schemes, as currently structured, have to be reformulated, obviously it's not something we anticipate will be done without due consideration on how to transition current entitlements into that environment. So the long and short of it is that I think that question will be better responded to once the clarity, which clarity we hope, or we have been informed, will be coming before the end of the month. Mm-hmm. So I can drop an email to say. But I don't know if Prof wants to respond.
As I said earlier, that the vision, the long-term vision was indeed to move a
to grow the pool of insured people in healthcare South Africa. This has been based on this in the 80s, nothing new. NSAID based on this in the 80s. The idea was to incrementally increase the pool, but ultimately all folk who were employed could in fact contribute. And this newer development, I think, are encouraging in terms of going that route. The council fees are playing a role, having been experienced and exposed to managing the medical aid industry for so many years, more than a decade now. We feel we can contribute with some expertise in the council debating the issues around developing NHR.
Thank you. I was in Ghana last week, and they have national health insurance. And it seems that this is doing well, but I didn't have time to visit. And but so.
I'll give you a document.
It's very interesting.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to go and see what, because they were claiming that it's doing well. And one of the reasons why they were putting forward was that most of those countries don't have insurances, I'm told. So it was easy for them to go into it because there's been no insurance. But I don't know. Maybe it's one place that we would need to visit and see when we talk about national health insurance. But that's a question. Probably these are just last few questions. Why are the provincial, why is it legal that the medical aid have got to go through the province, not contract, right, I mean, different public hospitals for medical aid? Why is it legal? Is it a law that they must go through the province? Because it seems as if it's the province that has got a problem. You might find that the institutions themselves don't have a problem.
There's another question. Okay, Martin.
Thank you for the presentation. I've just got two questions that was for interest. One, this demarcation is this testing. Now that we're approaching the end of the year, but now it's end of the year, how long is the term of this demarcation, of this test testing? Secondly, the Okanogram of the subcommittee noting that we have got a small committee of 12 in the council, and then Chairperson and Secretary, and also 10 other members who are highly skilled. My question is that now, what is the organogram for this subcommittee, noting the complaints that are so, that list is so long for the complaints, and there is a appeals committee, I can see the appeals committee, but what is the organogram for these committees? Thank you.
People are becoming interested. I thought the stomach was twofold. That's all I noticed. Okay, it's memoir and then.
Okay, it's just one. On the very front page was acting. So the Hollywood.
Acting.
In SA.
And he was acting when he was here. He was acting. He was, and he's still acting. Okay.
Mine is just a small question, very little. I just want to check when you say you want to regulate, especially the tariffs, because you started, as you are toothpick, want to check how long is it going to take, you know, for you to say, when I go for an injection in an hospital, this fee is going to be here in Cape Town, in Joburg, everywhere. Just the regulation. How long do you think it's going to be? Because I think that's where they are ripping us off.
Thanks, my dear. Okay, those are the questions.
Maybe the other question is that with cases that you have taken to court, usually, do you win them? And if you win them, do they, what is that term? Do they lose a case with a good cost? Or it's just goodbye, we won, and everybody pays his or her fees? The complainant and the U.S. accused. No, them as accused and the U.S. as complainant.
Thanks, Chair. With regards to the first question of direct contracting, I think very early on, we explored that approach. But at that stage, we were advised that the province will be the better, a more appropriate custodian of the contracting party. That is because, one, individual hospitals might not necessarily have the capability to contract. But secondly, the thinking was that if the province contracts, the revenue generated won't prejudice non-contracted entities. For example, if you've got a regional and a provincial or tertiary institution, a regional hospital might not have all the services and might therefore be prejudiced. But there were many other factors. But as to whether it's legal or not, I'm not certain. Perhaps my colleague from the department might answer that. In terms of the demarcation debate, the process is being managed by Treasury. We are just one of the participants, as in the Department of Health. The reason for our participation was largely to ensure that whatever outcome is around there and whatever legislation flows therefrom is one that will be consistent with the prevailing health policy in the country. Obviously, the challenge we now face is precisely what I indicated, that the process seemed to be, captured by vested interests, and that is why we are thinking that perhaps a different route might be appropriate, because a parallel insurance process would not only harm the current arrangement, but even future arrangements, but it's also prejudicial to members, most of whom are hoodwinked into this product. With regards to organograms, our council has got subcommittees, which subcommittees are the participation of which is largely due to pertains largely to members of council. But with regards to the appeals committee specifically, there is a council member, but there are external people with legal expertise, because what the Medical Schemes Act has created is a quasi judicial process where your complaints can be dealt with without you having to refer to court. So the appeals committee will have a council member, and the appeals board is appointed by the minister. That's the highest body to which an aggrieved party can appeal. That is appointed by the minister. So the minister will decide, which three people from the X stipulated number that he or she feels, in this case it's a he, which three people does he feel needs to be part of the appeals committee. The issue of the acting registrar.
Why don't you leave it for the chairperson?
Yeah, I wanted to just be addressed by the chairperson.
Yeah, I think that's you justified in being concerned about that. Just to give the background, the acting CEO registrar was acting while the real or full or non-acting registrar was on leave for 6 months. That's when you met him the first time. Since then, we've engaged in the process of appointing a new registrar. And currently, as I sit here, we have applicants, we have shortlisted, and we hope to make an appointment in a few days' time. So at least the acting part of the registrar's work will come to an end.
Okay, thank you. That will be a Christmas present for the one who will win.
Yeah. Okay, so you've completed the questions, eh?
In terms of court cases, if we win cases, yes, the medical scheme will pay us costs back. And If we have not gone too much into our financials, you would have seen that some on our other incomes, we have recovered some costs from the medical schemes.
Thank you. The
let's give it.
Okay, I'm just asking myself as I'm seated here that, I mean, isn't there something, I don't know what to call it, but as I was paging through here, I don't see anything that talks to HIV/AIDS in terms of maybe, or is it something that legally cannot talk about or have in presentations? Where we would see maybe some type of statistics that shows, I see here you've got where you say GPs 8.1% in terms of payment planning and all that. But can't we have something along the lines of HIV/AIDS that will give us an idea? I mean, not now, but maybe in your future report, also include that so that it gives us an idea of where we're going as a country in terms of HIV/AIDS, people who can afford it, these are the people who cannot afford it. Because every day we talk about people, black people who are poor and checks in HIV, blah, blah, blah. But there's still that other group where people can still afford the ARVs and all that. I'm just saying in future maybe. Not now, because I think it will give us an idea of what is happening, medical aid, you know, with HIV issues, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, that, I don't think you need to respond now. But you can say, but I suspect you, it's not only about HIV. It's probably it's about the disease profile in South Africa as to, because what we're trying to look, we're trying to look at those who can afford and those who cannot afford. Because we've got the statistics from the development of the public health sector, but we seem not to be having what's happening in the private health sector. But you can show us the disease profile. Probably you need to communicate with the Academy of Science and Technology, or even NHLS, or Lancet, wherever that can help you. But it's something that you would definitely need to see the disease. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we've come to an end of the meeting. Let's thank you very much on behalf of the committee. We say thank you very much, and we are hoping that you will do the best, because we are members of the NetGallery too, ourselves. Mm-hmm. So you are protecting us. But we are looking for a situation where everybody in South Africa would be covered. I think that's the bottom line, whether I do have money or I don't have, but I need to be covered, because this affects our health system. Thank you very much. But before you leave, because you'll be disturbing us, okay, can I say, thank you very much, Department. I nearly forgot that you were here. So thank you very much for assisting us, and the assisting that we're going to do is asking from you. But we'll talk about what we have. Members, thank you very much. I really did not expect that we're going to be all here since the Parliament has closed, but we have managed to come all of you. And that shows the commitment on your side. So I honestly want to thank you for coming and attending this meeting. And I think there's nobody who's taking this thing, but if you still want to remain. I'm hoping that we are not going to be, we won't be called for an urgent meeting. But if it so happens, then we'll try. I'm keeping all of you your phone numbers. But it does not mean that we don't phone each other during the holidays, wishing each other happy Christmas and happy New Year. But I want to say, I might not see you, because I'm staying in rural areas in Solo. I must say, I wish you a very happy Christmas and a prosperous New Year. Tomorrow we're opening that hospital that Lawrence delegation Eastern Cape, which is actually where I come from. They're opening it tomorrow. So I'm going there, and you are invited, but I'm sure more those who want to come, they can give their name to Ryoga so that we can organize with Ubotella to make sure that it pays for them. But you definitely are invited. There's the 1st of December, which is the World AIDS Day. We'll try to find out from the department why they're not inviting us. I think they are going to invite us, but they haven't decided where the event is going to be. But we'll keep you informed as to what's happening. Thank you very much. If you have had a good year, there might have been challenges, there might have been good things. If I've been very unfair to you sometimes, asking you to come here and mention those that are late. I apologize. This was basically because I wanted us to do the rest of it. But if I've done something good, I think take it and make sure that we continue it. Thank you very much. I think next year we'll organize a Christmas party. Unfortunately, this year we're all new. It's only the few members. It's only Mike who's old here. So next year we'll organize something. So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, members.
Okay, sorry.
What do you think, Leo?
No, thanks a lot.
Let's go on this, I'm not going to finish before.